I'm Victor Beatty. This is VOA News. The Trump administration attempting to head off potential investigations involving the U.S. military in Afghanistan and Israel in the Middle East warned the International Criminal Court Monday it will face a tough response. White House National Security Advisor John Bolton called the ICC ineffective, unaccountable, and outright dangerous. Bolton said the U.S. would use any means necessary to protect its citizens and those of its allies from unjust prosecution by what he called this illegitimate court. Bolton said that might include banning ICC officials from visiting the U.S., sanctioning funding, and prosecuting them in U.S. courts. The National Security Advisor also announced the closure of the Palestine Liberation Office in Washington out of concern for a potential ICC probe of Israel by Palestinians. Palestinian diplomat Saeb Erekat responded by saying the office closure, coupled with recent cuts or redirection of aid to Palestinian people in recent weeks, is affirmation of what he called the Trump administration's policy to collectively punish the Palestinian people. At least six people were killed Monday in an al-Shabaab attack involving an explosives-laden vehicle near a government building in the capital Mogadishu. Nearly 20 others were wounded, the second such attack in the city so far this month. In Nigeria, at least 18 people were killed after a gas depot explosion in Lafia, capital of the central state of Nasarawa. Dozens were burned. The White House has confirmed President Donald Trump received a letter from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un asking for a second meeting following their June summit in Singapore. This is VOA News. Turkey's defense minister has appealed to Syria and Russia to halt airstrikes on rebel-held Idlib province, which borders Turkey. Hulusi Akar called for a ceasefire and stability. Senior UN emergency official Mark Lowcock warned Monday that such an attack could lead to another major loss of life and migration. He said more than 30,000 have already fled their homes. More casualties have also been reported as a result of an ongoing government bombardment. Florence is a powerful Category 4 hurricane heading for the southeast U.S. coast with winds in excess of 200 kilometers per hour. Hundreds of thousands have or will soon be evacuated inland ahead of the storm's expected landfall Thursday. Forecaster Ken Graham said the effects of the storm will be serious.
The rainfall is going to be very intense in a lot of different areas. So the storm surge right along the coast, a significant life-threatening storm surge associated with this hurricane, but also the rainfall right along the coast and also stretching well inland, we can see rainfall totals a foot or higher in some cases, and that's going to cause some life-threatening flash flooding. So storm surge, flash flooding, heavy rainfall, and of course the winds associated with this. A lot of trees down, a lot of power outages.
States of emergency have already been declared in South and North Carolina as well as Virginia. California State Governor Jerry Brown has signed landmark legislation committing his state to a 100% clean electricity grid by the year 2045.
California is committed to doing whatever is necessary to meet the existential threat of climate change. And yes, it is an existential threat. No matter what the naysayers may say, it is a real present danger to California and to the people of the world.
The measure mandates California utilities generate 60% of their energy from wind, solar, and other renewable sources by 2030 and carbon-free sources to generate electricity by 2045. Brown is preparing to host a summit of climate change leaders from around the world in San Francisco on Wednesday. Monday, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned of a dark and dangerous future as a result of climate change. He said the world must change course by 2020 or risk runaway climate change. Insurgent attacks on Afghan security forces have left dozens dead. Attacks ranged across at least four northern provinces, all claimed by the Taliban as the pace of fighting picks up. And Zimbabwe's new government is sworn in Monday, with the finance minister pledging to accelerate plans to pay back international lenders and cut government spending, as well as reintroduce the Zimbabwean dollar. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambia denies falling into the so-called China debt trap.
Zambia, under the current visit to China, only acquired $30 million zero interest loan. The majority of the deals that were done were private sector.
Emma Chanda is spokesperson for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. Is Malawi's current vice president on the brink of a political alliance with former President Joyce Banda ahead of the 2019 election? Liberia has been suspended from the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. And who killed a popular district police commander in Uganda?
The assassination is yet another gruesome one that we condemn strongly. And the information we have is that they used the similar method of the border, and they fled the scene.
That's Ugandan police spokesperson Emilia Kiyama. There's been a changing of the guard in the leadership of Angola's ruling MPLA, and we'll tell you about Guinea-Bissau's marine green turtles nesting. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Zambian government said it has not fallen into the so-called China debt trap. This comes after the government denied reports that it has mortgaged much of its resources and institutions to Chinese companies because it cannot pay its debt owed to China. Emos Chanda, spokesperson for President Edgar Lungu, says Zambia acquired $30 million, a zero-interest loan from China during the recent China-Africa summit. He said another $30 million was given as a grant to construct a modern international conference center to host the 2022 African Union Summit. In another development, Zambia's finance minister has asked the attorney general to find the source of an article which suggests that she authored a letter blaming the late President Michael Sata for the country's current economic problems.
There is no economic crisis in the country. The economy is growing at 4%. But that is not to say that there are no economic problems. There are economic problems, but you can't call them a crisis. So the Minister of Finance is, one, correct. There is no crisis. Two, the letter attributed to her was mischievous. It's a product of fake news, and there are many people in the habit of doing this. They do this to all of us every day, but it's quite irresponsible to do that to the Minister of Finance because the repercussions on the exchange rate, on the economy. It's not to the policy of government to respond to online letters, online newspaper reports like that. But I think that she had to do it because it was being quoted around that was her position.
So, Amos, the finance minister is asking the attorney general of Zambia to what? Find yes. The source of this article?
The attorney general working with ZICTA, which is the regulator for online publications and internet-based applications and platforms, to try and trace the authors of that malicious letter. If those people are found, obviously they should be brought before the law and answer why they are engaging in criminal mischief.
If your government knows and the finance minister knows that whatever is in this letter is not the truth, why bother even trying to get to the attorney general to find a source?
Yes, why would you let criminals who are attributing things that are not said by the minister, why let them do that? If when they say that and causes the kwacha to tumble, say, by 1%, causes the yields in the bonds to go up, makes the same debt they are complaining about more costly, why would you not want those criminals brought before the law? It is illegal to attribute something that has criminal elements. So, yes, it is untrue. But if it is causing damage, if it has any criminal element, it must be prosecutable if it is prosecutable.
Amos, you did travel to China with President Lungu. One of the stories that came out that I'm reading is that your government was letting Chinese companies take over Zambian public institutions because your government owes too much money to China.
That is precisely the point the Minister of Finance is making, that the phenomenon of fake news, misrepresentations and total concoctions, fabrication could in fact damage the economy. There is not too much money owed to China. One, there is no Zambian debt crisis with China. Two, three, There is not a single Chinese company taking over any single Zambian company, because Zambia has never defaulted on any of its instruments, any of its debt instruments it has issued. Zambia, under the current visit to China, only acquired $30 million zero interest loan. The other $30 million is a grant to help construct the modern international conference center that will host the 2022 African Union Summit. The majority of the deals that we have done were private sector, Zambian private sector companies engaging with Chinese companies. So I'm pleased that Voice of America would call and ask direct questions and give the side of the story of the Zambian government, but to emphasize that the phenomenon of fossil orchestrated by those who want to damage the economy.
Amos Chanda, spokesman for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has asked for the deployment of over 20,000 local defense personnel in Kampala and neighboring areas. This followed last Saturday's assassination of senior police officer Mohamed Chirumara by unknown gunmen in Kampala. Mugumi Davis Rakaringe reports from Kampala.
Uganda's police spokesperson, Emelani Kaima, confirmed the police officer, Chirumira, was murdered at Bulenga, a Kampala suburb, on Saturday night.
The assassination is yet another gruesome one that we condemn strongly. And the information we have is that they used the similar method of the border, and they fled the scene immediately after that crime.
Chirumira was a great critic of corruption in the police force and was instrumental in fighting the high crime rate in the country. Yet, at the time of his death, Chirumira was battling charges of abuse of office and corruption, charges he said were meant to silence his stance against social injustices. Several government officials, members of the security force, as well as religious leaders, have been killed in recent days by unknown gunmen driving motorcycles, locally known as bodabodas. Also recently murdered by unknown assailants was parliamentarian Colonel Ibrahim Abiriga, a prominent member of the ruling NRM party, who was vocal during the debates to amend the constitution to remove the age limit for one contesting the presidency of Uganda. Speaking to mourners on Sunday, Sheikh Muhammad Ali Waiswa, the deputy head of the Islamic religion in Uganda, asked the government to come forward and combat these murders.
The death rates have not stopped, with flyers around the town indicating a list of sheikhs to be killed. The question on every Muslim's mind is who is next.
Waiswa says the government should launch an investigation into this and come out with a report on who is behind the killings in the country. While addressing the nation this Sunday, President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni said his government will deploy 24,000 village police officers, locally known as Local Defense Units, or LDU, in Kampala and surrounding towns.
We are now going to call up the reserves and they man these little training centers, and we arm them. Of course, it will create a little bit of expense, an extra 57 billion on the budget, but that's no problem. We must make sure that total peace against crime is restored. So this will be gone for maybe a year until the cameras and other places are in town. Then we can ask these young people to go back to do their other work.
President Museveni has suggested the installation of surveillance cameras, electronic number plates for vehicles are some of the measures to combat murders in the country. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 11th. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Let's send special greetings to all our listeners on our VOA affiliate stations around Africa. Daybreak Africa time. It's 14 and a half minutes past the hour. A meeting between Malawian Vice President Saulos Chilima and former President Joyce Banda over the weekend is generating a lot of buzz. In a campaign speech over the weekend, the Vice President said he shares the same vision of Malawi with the former president. Local media say the Vice President's United Transformation Movement, UTM Party, and the former president's People's Party may form an alliance to challenge incumbent president Arthur Peter Mutharika ahead of the 2019 presidential election. Vincent Conway is a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi.
It was heavily rumored, and we have no evidence, that the former president, Joyce Banda, had made a deal with the current governing president, Peter Mutharika, for her to be able to come back from her self-imposed exile so that she's not being prosecuted for issues connected to Cashgate. Now, all the expectation were that she should go into an electoral alliance with the ruling Democratic Progressive Party. But all of a sudden, we see her meeting with the current Vice President, Thabo Chirima. Now, it may not be really, really surprising when you look at the circumstances where we are coming from. Joyce Banda and Thabo Chirima are victims of the same circumstances where the Vice President and their bosses have gone different ways. So that would bring them together to wage a war against the Mutharika family.
If the speculation is right, and these two, Thabo Chirima being the sitting vice president and Dr. Joyce Banda being the former vice president, do you think their alliance, if indeed they put pen to paper, would pose a significant threat in next year's general election?
Well, I have maintained that the political value of the immediate former president, Joyce Banda, is not very, very significant, because soon after the 2014 election, she disappeared from the political front for quite a good time until when she came back this year. However, symbolically, it may send a message which may have an impact on the people to say, maybe let's try Thabo Chirima, maybe he's a person of value. It's a situation of if then, because if you've got someone of significance like a former president giving support, symbolically it would send a message of goodwill which may add value to the movement that the current vice president is championing. Therefore, that kind of electoral alliance may bring value to these two if they come together. But substantively, the former president, Joyce Banda, I do not believe he has the pulling or the following that he used to command when she was the president.
Talking about the UTM party led by Thabo Chirima, some Malawians are saying this is not the first time where a party has launched and has created a lot of excitement only to flame out ahead of the election, and they predict that a similar thing could occur to the UTM party in the run-up to next year's election. What is your take?
My take is that it is correct. During the time of Bakiri Muruzi, we had the National Democratic Alliance, which was championed by Brown Mpinganjila. It really started very well. All of a sudden, it became a bubble. And then we have had the different splinter groups from the ruling parties, like Rolf Patel and the others, but they never had any impact on elections in Malawi. However, with the current vice president, the situation is very, very different. Malawians are quite frustrated people. There's a lot of disenchantment with the ruling party. And it looks like Malawians were looking for a kind of a political savior, a kind of a revolutionary person who would come up and disturb the entire status quo and move things to another level. And it seems like Chirima is striking a very good chord with the frustrated masses.
Vincent Conway is a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with U.S. Peter Clote from Lilongwe. The Liberian government says it will take responsibility but not the blame for the country's suspension from the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, known as the EITI. The initiative makes possible transparency in the governance of the oil, gas, and mining sectors. The EITI says it suspended Liberia because Liberia failed to publish a report from 2016 to the present. Liberian Information Minister Eugene Nabwe tells Moses Gaziewu in Monrovia that the suspension was not surprising because the EITI refused to give Liberia more time to get the outstanding report ready.
We have requested for the EITI to allow us to some time to deal with all of the issues we had. Because of technical reasons, they didn't do it. One of the technical reasons was that the President of the Republic hadn't appointed a board in keeping with the EITI law and the rules and regulations and processes. So it's not a big deal because we are very progressive, and this government will resolve all of these issues and we will be in compliance again. But it's not a big deal.
Why weren't you in compliance with some of these regulations? You know about them.
This report is from 2016. This government came into power 2018. So the report from 2016 wasn't done in 2016. It wasn't done in 2017. It wasn't done in early 2018 until the government came to power. So it was not a default by this government. The EITR process allowed the exigency of time. This is a 2018 fiscal report that wasn't published. So, yes, as a government, we have to take responsibility, but we will not take the blame because we, in 2016, were not the government in power. So this new administration has been engaging with the EITR. We send the new director to Germany. The president sent him in there to engage the EITR for extension. They did not grant the extension, but yet we will continue to comply with the requirement because we want to be a part of the EITR process. So to say that this government is in default is not fair, it's wrong, because this is a government that just took over office to make a report since 2016. But the EITR process is for transparency, and we are very happy that we will remain apart in spite of this temporary setback. We believe we can resolve the matter that's ahead.
Mr. Nangwe, is this so embarrassing for the government of President George Weah?
No, it's not. It's embarrassing for the country that a report that should have been issued since 2016 was not issued. It wasn't issued in 2016, it wasn't issued in 2017, and Mr. President took over in 2018. So how can he be embarrassed by the fault of a government that he inherited the power from? For Mr. Weah and the government, we are not shirking away from our responsibility, but we will not take the blame for the lapses that did not happen in 2016 and 2017. But as a government, we'll move forward in 2018 to resolve all of the outstanding issues.
That's Liberian Information Minister Eugene Nambwe speaking with reporter Moses Gaziewu in Monrovia. Angolan President João Lourenço on Saturday assumed the leadership of the ruling MPLA party from former President José Eduardo dos Santos, who led the party for almost 40 years. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpavai says the position will strengthen President Lourenço's hand in his fight against corruption.
Mr. João Lourenço, in an inaugural speech, said the main points of his mandate want to be against corruption and the changement of the leadership style. So he must have the political bureau meeting next week when we see some kind of appointments that we will have to work with together. But there are a lot of expectations about the real mandate. Now, Mr. Lourenço has all the power. So both opposition parties and civil society now are expecting what Mr. Lourenço will do just now.
Would this include that he might have to reshuffle the cabinet, bring in new people?
Maybe, but before the end of the year. Especially if you're taking in account the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, we will have a negotiation with the cabinet. And in accordance with these political arrangements, we can expect some kind of reshuffle of the cabinet.
So what did the former president, Eduardo dos Santos, now he's stepping down finally after ruling the country since 1975 or so, what did he have to say to the people? There's a story that he made some mistakes. What did he say?
The main criticism inside the party, the ruling party, and also from the opposition parties and civil society is corruption. Corruption is the main damage of Mr. dos Santos. But he didn't say anything. There are narratives of mixes between the presidential family and business, public enterprises, and so on. We will see what Mr. Lourenço will do in the next months and until the end of the year in the next Congress, what will happen. We will see. But until now, there are some kind of arrangements and celebrations of the former president. African politics is a mix between traditions and modernity. So what we will see is Mr. Lourenço could have at Central Committee some kind of arrangement, some kind of votes to implement the reforms. But the important question is the IMF is coming, and the IMF will put on the table reforms.
Thank you for speaking with us again, Mario.
Thank you, James.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpavai speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. Marine green turtles nesting among Guinea-Bissau's Biagos archipelago are part of a unique population of turtles that is the largest population in Africa and the second densest group in the world. In the coming months, the eggs on Palau Island, which will hatch as babies make their way to the sea. While across the globe, male turtle populations are declining, marine turtles expert Rita Patricio, who works in the Biagos, says the turtles on Palau are unique because there are so many males.
The nesting density in this place where we work in Palau, it's probably the second with highest density. It's really impressive. So it's really important site. Very unique.
And why do you think it is unique like that? Is it because of the biosphere of the Biagos?
That has to be one of the issues and then one of the aspects. But then something really interesting is that this, although we speak of the population from the Biagos, because the in a lot of the islands there is important nesting, more than 90% of the nesting is at this very small island called Poilão, and this is traditionally a sacred island. So it's really conservation, this conservation as of this population has been going on for centuries, because for the Biagos population, Poilão is sacred. They are not allowed to set foot on the island except in fanado ceremonies for the men. They are not allowed to shed blood on the island. So although they would use the resource marine turtles, and although on the other islands they do capture marine turtles, and it used to be more related to ceremonies, now it's a bit more widespread. They just kill to eat them. And that's what we try to fight. At the Biagos, they wouldn't do that because it's so special and sacred. So we think that also had an impact.
What did you find this year that was different from years past, or was it the same?
Well, actually, it's a very strange year because, so it's a low year. We have less turtles, but that's okay because naturally sea turtle populations, they fluctuate because it's not the same females nesting every year. So they come nest 1 year and then they take a break for like 2 years or so to recover. And so every year you have a different stock. Let's say every 3 years it's more or less cyclic. So this year there are not many turtles, but there's loads of male turtles. And this is really important because with the marine turtles, the sex is determined by temperature. When the eggs are incubating, when it's warmer, you'll have more females. And when it's cooler temperatures, you have males being born. And now that is a big concern because of climate change. So you have all these places getting warmer and warmer. So the biggest population of green turtles in the world is in a rain island in Australia. And there's no vegetation, and they already found out that it's like over 98% of females being born. And then it's too late. So the special thing about Poilão is that we studied the sex ratios. We saw that there's still a lot of males being produced, and one of the things is thanks to the native forest that it's still pristine. And this year was amazing. So in that aspect, we saw so many males.
That was Rita Patricio, a sea turtle expert working in the Biagos. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Lisbon. And that is it for this Tuesday, September 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very productive week.
Hello, I'm Lenore Moudou, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we will take a look at the ongoing Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Our guest is Dr. Malonga Myatudila, senior public health specialist and one of the doctors who first discovered the Ebola virus in the DRC in 1976. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Science Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.